On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Perchlorate Remediation Technologies, developed by the ITRC Perchlorate Team. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Roxboro, North Carolina. I'm going to serve as a moderator today. I'm going to cover some introductory material in the next few slides and then quickly turn the presentation over to our instructors from the ITRC Perchlorate Team. As listed on the slide, today's training course is based on the ITRC Technical and Regulatory Guidance Document, Remediation Technologies for Perchlorate Contamination in Water and Soil, the PERC-2 document. Today's training is an introduction to this document, and we do encourage you to review the document itself. If you haven't downloaded it before the training class, we're going to take you to a link at the end of today's class where you can download a PDF of this document. We also make available the presentation itself to download. In addition to what you'll see on the slides during today's training, there's more information available in the speaker's notes section of the downloaded version. And again, we'll take you to links at the end of the training where you can download both the presentation and the document that serves as the basis for today's training class. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, CLUIN. Please move to slide 2. If you're using the CLUIN system, it's a series of orange buttons along the top that allow you to navigate. And most often, you'll use the third button, the single right arrow, to move forward through the presentation. Today's course is scheduled for 2.25 hours. For our phone line participants, do not put the call on hold. We may pick up some background music if you do that. It is *6 to mute your line and #6 to unmute so that you can ask questions during the question and answer breaks. For our phone line participants, you're welcome to ask questions out loud. For the simulcast participants, the question mark at the top of the slide is going to allow you to send in questions. Anyone is welcome to use that at any time during the presentation to send in a question or a comment, and I'll receive that as a moderator. If you're having trouble with any of the features of the CLUIN website, you may need to turn off your pop-up blockers. As we move through the slides today, each of you are in control of which slide you're on. The slide number is in the upper left-hand corner, and the instructors are going to say the slide number throughout the presentation. You can use the arrow icons at the top to move through the presentation. There's also a list of slide numbers along the left that will allow you to move through the presentation. The list of slide numbers along the left is especially useful during the question and answer breaks, because if you want to jump back to a slide and then come back forward to where we are in the presentation. We do have a feedback form, and that link is available from the last slide of the presentation. We do ask that everyone on the call today fill out that feedback form. We use the information to help improve ITRC training classes, and your feedback is very important to us. Today's class is being recorded, and we offer archives of past classes, and they're available at the website listed on this slide. There's over 45 classes from ITRC and several hundred from EPA overall. On slide 3, this is our disclaimer and copyright that we include in all ITRC training presentations. We ask that you please read over the slide. In short, it says that we've tried to provide accurate and reliable information, but do not warranty this material. We recommend you check with local, state, federal laws, as well as experts. ITRC does not endorse any specific products. ITRC's presentations and documents are copyrighted, so please ask permission before using. On slide 4, this is some basic information about ITRC. To learn more, you can visit the ITRC website, and I've listed that at the top of the slide. ITRC is hosted by the Environmental Council of States, and overall, ITRC is a network that's led by state regulators. It includes federal partners, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry, academia, and community stakeholders. This diverse group works together to address a wide variety of topics. A topic may be associated with a technology or a type of contaminant or a certain type of site. They communicate their results through products like the technical and regulatory guidance documents and the internet-based and classroom training. I do encourage you to learn more about ITRC, both about the products that are available as well as what new things ITRC is working on to see if you want to become more involved with the development of the process. On slide 5, this is a list of course topics that we've offered in 2010. We're going to be working soon on our schedule for 2011. We'll continue to offer classes from previous years as well as develop new classes and offer them for the first time in 2011. We also have a two-day classroom training. This year we've offered the class on vapor intrusion pathway. In 2011, we'll offer the class on vapor intrusion as well. And also, we have a new training class on LNAPLS. That's a two-day classroom training that we are working on. On slide 6, I'll introduce our instructors. All our instructors were members of the ITRC perchlorate team. That team was led by Lee Lipton-Cott from the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. Rose Knox is a senior environmental engineer at the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection in Boston. She conducts technical analysis to support the development of policies and regulations under the Massachusetts Contingency Plan. Bruce Robinson is a senior hydrogeologist and ITRC stakeholder from Tempe, Arizona. He has 20 years of environmental project experience with 10 years of consulting experience and 10 years of regulatory experience. He's worked for the Gila River Indian Community Department of Environmental Quality. Bob Barnwell is a professional geologist with the Alabama Department of Environmental Management located in Montgomery. His duties include oversight of perchlorate assessments at NASA and Department of Defense facilities in Alabama. Paul Hatzinger is a senior scientist at the Princeton Research Center of Shaw Environmental. His current areas of research focus on the development of in situ and ex situ bioremediation technologies for emerging contaminants, the use of isotopic methods to distinguish contaminant sources, and bacterial transport in groundwater aquifers. If you move to slide 7, I will now turn today's presentation over to Rose Knox of the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection. Rose?
Thanks, Juliana. Good morning, everyone. Let's begin on slide 7. Public awareness and concern regarding perchlorate have increased over the last 10, 12 years, and there is a growing database of occurrence showing that perchlorate has been detected in all media and found around the world. Here in the United States, perchlorate has been detected at varying levels in drinking water and other media in 45 states. However, there is no national system to track perchlorate detection, so really the full extent of occurrence across the U.S. is unknown. Now, the concern with perchlorate is that it can affect the thyroid gland, and the thyroid is important for proper growth and development, which is critical in fetuses and newborns. And we are seeing levels of perchlorate in the environment which may cause an unacceptable risk to human health and may need to be addressed. So we're here today to present you with technologies that you may consider at sites with perchlorate contamination in water and soil. The basis for today's training is the ITRC document, Remediation Technologies for Perchlorate Contamination in Water and Soil, PERC-2. And that document was finalized by the ITRC perchlorate team in 2008. And the overall goal of that document, as well as today's training, is really to provide you with reliable guidance to help streamline the evaluation and selection of perchlorate remedial technologies. Slide 8. Relative to other contaminants, perchlorate is a new contaminant of concern, and those addressing perchlorate in the environment really don't yet have the same level of experience or expertise in addressing perchlorate as compared to more conventional contaminants. But there have been a lot of studies conducted over the last 4 or 5 years and studies and research, and there has been rapid advancement made specifically in the areas of measurement and treatment of perchlorate. So what we're presenting today really does represent state-of-the-art information, and the hope is that it will help you make decisions on selecting and implementing the most appropriate technology for your site. Slide 9. I'm going to start us off today, and I'm going to provide an overview of background information related to perchlorate. We do want to spend as much time as possible today talking about the technologies. So I'm going to try to keep it brief. There's a lot of key information that I want to get across. But I will do that in the next 20 minutes, and then I'll hand things off to Bruce Robinson, who's an ITRC stakeholder. And Bruce will present and discuss considerations for treatment selection. And he'll discuss regulatory and technological considerations, as well as stakeholder concerns at perchlorate sites. And then we'll go right into the discussion on the specific technologies. And Bob Barnwell of Alabama DEM and Paul Hatzinger of Shaw Environmental will make those presentations. You'll notice that the weight of information presented today is towards those technologies to address perchlorate in water. And that's really because perchlorate is so soluble and mobile that most perchlorate sites include water as an impacted medium. So Bob Barnwell will go first, and he's going to present physical technologies to address perchlorate in water. And he'll talk about ion exchange, which is the most commonly used technology today, but then he'll also discuss reverse osmosis, granular activated carbon, and other physical technologies as well, including emerging and innovative technologies. At that point, Juliana will moderate our first question and answer session, and that will allow you to ask questions on the first half of today's training. When the Q&A session is completed, Paul Hatzinger of Shaw Environmental will talk about biological treatment systems to address the chlorate in water. And Paul will talk in detail about both in-situ and ex-situ biological treatment systems. At that point, we're going to shift over and talk about soil treatment technologies, and Bob Barnwell will make that presentation, and Bob will discuss thermal processes as well as biological treatment processes, again, both in-situ and ex-situ. And then he'll also talk about using phytoremediation to address the chlorate in the environment. That will wrap up the discussion on the specific technologies, and then we'll use the rest of our time today to highlight what we've presented through two case studies. I'll present the first case study, which is the Merrimack River case study. I'm going to detail source identification of perchlorate detected in a Massachusetts town's water supply. And then Bruce Robinson will present the second case study, and that's the Aerojet case study. Aerojet's facility in Rancho Cordova, California. Bruce is going to detail the extensive remediation activities conducted to date, both in water and soil. Bruce will briefly summarize, after his case study, what we've talked about today. He'll hand things over to Juliana, and she's first going to provide you with links to information and studies related to what we've presented today, and then she will moderate our second and final Q&A session before concluding today's training. Slide 10.
Well, this is Juliana. Can you pull back a little bit from the speaker so that we're getting a little extra noise there?
Okay.
Thanks.
Sure, no problem. The ITRC perchlorate team was formed in 2004 to address technical issues associated with perchlorate. The team consists of members representing federal agencies, state and federal regulators, academia, public stakeholders, and private consultants. And you can see a breakdown of participation on the team here on slide 10, and this is as of 2007. Now, today's training is based on the second document developed by the team, PERC 2. The first document, PERC 1, was developed by the team in 2005. And that first document provides an overview of issues, status, and remedial options. And it really provides a wide range of information related to the key issues associated with perchlorate. And that includes detailed discussion on sources, use, and occurrence, analytical techniques, risk issues, risk management strategies, and regulatory status. The first document also provides an overview of the technologies. So the second document in today's training really picks up from where the first document concluded and really expands on that technology discussion. There's been a number of training sessions conducted by the team on the first document. Those materials have been archived, and Juliana will provide a link to that information at the end of today's training. We don't have any formal plans to develop a third document, but I just want to briefly mention a couple of areas of interest that the team has. And one is on the differentiation between naturally occurring and man-made perchlorate. That's a topic of much current research over the last couple of years. And one of our presenters today, Paul Hatzinger, I know has done a lot of research in this area. The second area of interest is the development of best management practices in the hopes of preventing future releases of perchlorate to the environment. Here in Massachusetts, we've developed BMPs for two perchlorate-containing sources. One is fireworks, and the second is black agents. And I can tell you, as the contact person for those BMPs, or questions on those BMPs, they've provided a lot of useful information to interested parties. Slide 11. So I'm going to start my overview. Over the next 20 minutes, I'm going to get a lot of information out there because there's a lot of information regarding perchlorate to tell. Most of the information I'm presenting can be found in the first overview document, and again, Juliana will get a link to that document to at the end of today's training. We thought it was worthwhile spending the next 20 minutes or so discussing this background information, really to put the rest of today's presentation in its proper context. Sections 1 through 5 specifically of the first overview document is where you can find more details on what I'm presenting. And for some of the more recent background information that I'm presenting, such as some of the studies, the food studies, some of the information on updates to regulatory status, that's not in our document, which was finalized in 2005. We will provide links to that information at the end of today's training. Slide 12. So what is perchlorate? Perchlorate is a negatively charged ion, so it's an anion, and it consists of four oxygen atoms surrounding a central chlorine atom, so it's ClO4. It combines with cations to form salts. The most common salts containing perchlorate include ammonium perchlorate, sodium perchlorate, and potassium perchlorate. Perchlorate is also found in perchloric acid. Now, perchlorate readily dissolves in water. It's soluble, and once it gets into the water, it moves pretty quickly. It's very mobile, and perchlorate slowly degrades in the environment. It is both stable and persistent, and those are the four important properties of perchlorate that you want to remember, that it's very soluble, mobile, stable, and persistent. Slide 13. As a result, it can contaminate our drinking water supplies and our food supplies, and therefore it presents a concern for human health. We have an abundant amount of evidence on the presence of perchlorate in our nation's drinking water. And while we don't have enough time this morning to go through that information, I did want to spend a couple of minutes and highlight some of the key locations or the key studies where we found perchlorate in our drinking water. And I'll start with EPA. US EPA monitored for perchlorate from 2001 to 2005 through the UCMR program. That's the Unregulated Contaminant Monitoring Rule program. They sampled 4,000 public water supplies across the country. 160 of them had detections of perchlorate ranging from 4 to over 400 parts per billion. 20% of those public water supplies, so about 30, had detections above 15. And 15 is the current interim health advisory, federal interim health advisory. And I'll talk about that health advisory in a couple of slides when I talk about updates to what's going on at the federal level with regulating perchlorate. In a separate study in California, about 6,700 public water supplies were tested. About 350 of them contained perchlorate. Also, the Lower Colorado River, which is a major source of irrigation and drinking water to Southern California, Nevada, Arizona, and New Mexico, contained perchlorate. Perchlorate's been found in western Texas in groundwater in an area exceeding 60,000 square miles. And lastly, in addition to California, there are two other states, New Jersey and Massachusetts, who have conducted extensive testing of their public water supplies and have found perchlorate in several of them. Now, perchlorate is also a concern in food, and we don't have as much information on the presence of perchlorate in our food, but more studies have been conducted over the last 2 or 3 years and are continuing to be conducted. One I want to mention, the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, conducted a very large study, a very large and comprehensive study back in 2006-2007, and it looked at 300 commonly consumed foods and found perchlorate in about 3/4 of them. And that indicates that perchlorate is common in the diet. Now, the FDA has gone on to do a supplemental food study, and that was completed in 2008, and the results were expected anytime end of this year into 2011. There's also been studies conducted on the presence of perchlorate in breast milk. I'll just mention one study was done in 2006-2007. The CDC, the Center for Diseases and Control, and Boston University tested the breast milk samples of 50 Boston area women, and perchlorate was detected in all of them. I know there's been other tests or other studies conducted on the presence of perchlorate in breast milk with similar findings. So perchlorate's been found in the majority, if not all, of the samples. So perchlorate's been found in water, it's been found in food, and the resulting exposures are a concern for human health. So now let's discuss what the risks are and what the acceptable levels of exposure are. Slide 14. Perchlorate's not currently considered a known or suspected human carcinogen. In fact, it's been used therapeutically to treat hypothyroidism, and hypothyroidism is a condition causing the overproduction of thyroid hormones. Perchlorate is one of several compounds that competitively interferes with iodide uptake in the thyroid, and iodide is essential for the synthesis of thyroid hormones. And those thyroid hormones, once they're released into the bloodstream, they regulate certain body functions. Now, in adults, the thyroid gland helps regulate metabolism. In children and fetuses, the thyroid helps in proper growth and development, which is critical. And based on available data, it is the pregnant women, developing fetus, and newborns that are most susceptible to the effects of perchlorate. But the other populations of concern, or subpopulations of concern, are children under the age of 12, postmenopausal women, and hypothyroid individuals. Slide 15. These next two slides, slide 15 and 16, I'm going to give you an update on regulatory status. And I'm going to start here on slide 15 with an update on the federal level. And I'm going to start in 2005 because that's when the National Academy of Sciences had reviewed, per EPA's request, all the existing toxicological information available in EPA's risk assessment and they recommended an oral reference dose of 0.0007 milligrams per kilogram per day. EPA adopted this value. They posted it on their toxicological database, that's IRIS, that's their integrated risk information system, and they went forward looking at whether a federal, a national standard for perchlorate was necessary. A couple years later, 2007, EPA makes a preliminary determination that they were not going to regulate perchlorate, really because they didn't have enough information to determine exposure and risk. About that time, a couple of large studies were released, or the results from a couple of large studies. One was the food study I mentioned by the FDA. Another one was a study conducted by the Center for Diseases and Control. The concern that was generated by the results of these studies, really, and the perceived inaction by EPA, was that as a population, we may be exposed to greater amounts of perchlorate than previously thought, and our exposure may pose a greater risk than previously thought. So what happened in 2008, Congress got involved, considered a couple of bills, if they became law, that would mandate EPA to amend the Safe Drinking Water Act and set a federal standard. EPA indicated at that time that they would make a determination by year's end, so Congress essentially backed off. In 2008, around, I think it was October, EPA makes another preliminary determination, again, not to regulate perchlorate, based on all the existing science, didn't believe a federal standard would be meaningful. That went out to public comment period, the end of 2008. 32,000 public comment comments, were received. Okay. In 2009, January, you had the Bush administration leaving, the Obama administration coming in. The National Academy of Sciences was asked in January of 2009 to get back and to weigh in again. It had been 5 years, a lot of information had come out since then, 32,000 scientific comments, so they pushed it to their way. Several months later, in August of 2009, EPA, under the new administration, indicated that they were going to go back out for public comment, which they did, and not really not have the National Academy of Sciences involved. So basically, went out for comment. October of 2009 is when the public comment period ended. So that's been a whole year, and there's been no movement. We haven't heard anything. So there's still no standard. However, I want to mention that an interim health advisory of 15 parts per billion is in effect. When EPA made that ruling in 2008 that they weren't going to regulate, they also recommended that interim health advisory of 15 parts per billion. That does include exposure to food and water. There was, before that, a preliminary remediation goal EPA set of 24.5. So it does replace that number. The 24.5 did not include exposure from food. It assumed all exposure to perchlorate came from water. Worth mentioning here before I go on the federal level, that the GAO, which is the Government Accountability Office, was asked, that's Congress's, the investigative arm of Congress. They were asked by the Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works to conduct research on perchlorate contamination in drinking water and food, asked a couple of states, Massachusetts and California being two of them, and the federal agencies, I think it was DOE, DOD, and NASA, and asked them about their experiences with addressing perchlorate in the environment, and developed a report on all that information. That report was finalized. It was finalized in August of 2010. Unfortunately, I did not get the link to Juliana before today's training, but I certainly will provide that link to the report to her when we finish this training today. And for those of you interested, it's GAO-10-769. Slide 16. So on the state level, states also have the right to establish and enforce drinking water standards. Two states have done so, Massachusetts and California, have promulgated MCLs. Massachusetts was the first state in 2006, promulgated an MCL of 2 parts per billion, also promulgated cleanup standards for soil and groundwater at that time. California followed in 2007 with an MCL of 6 parts per billion. My understanding is that California is currently reassessing their standard, and that's still ongoing, and I did check before today's training, and there was no final word on whether that number will stay the same or change. New Jersey had proposed a standard of 5 parts per billion, but that was delayed last year, so that didn't go forward and get promulgated. Wisconsin just promulgated a groundwater standard of 1 part per billion, and I believe Illinois is in the process of promulgating a groundwater standard. There are about 10 states, you don't see them all in the slide, but at least 10 states that have developed health advisories or guidance. Maine is not on this slide, and they just came out with an interim action level in drinking water of 1 part per billion. So there's at least 10 states that have developed guidance in for drinking water and or groundwater. Now, when the states review the existing toxicological information, they're all evaluating the same data, the same information. However, they can interpret it, that data, or evaluate it differently. They can use a different reference dose. They can look at how exposure or contribution from exposure comes from, water versus soil. And they'll apply different risk management decisions, and they can come up with different numbers. And when you look at the MCL in Massachusetts of 2 versus the MCL in California of 6, they differ slightly, but they still differ. And that's because there were different RFDs used, and the relative source contribution, the exposure, was looked at differently. Here in Massachusetts, we assume exposure from perchlorate, 20% of it comes from water, 80% comes from food. In California, it was a 60-40 split. Slide 17. Next couple of slides, I want to briefly touch upon sources and uses of perchlorate. Perchlorate is both naturally occurring and man-made. Most naturally occurring sources of perchlorate appear to be geographically limited to arid environments, and they usually result in lower concentrations of perchlorate in groundwater. We're talking single-digit ppb. Naturally occurring sources also include Chilean nitrate deposits, and they have been imported into the United States in significant quantities since the 1800s, and Chilean nitrate deposits have been used to produce fertilizer, make fireworks, and also explosives. Now, naturally occurring perchlorate is a concern, but the bigger concern is man-made perchlorate, and that's perchlorate that comes from industrial or military-related manufacturing or operations. And we'll talk about man-made perchlorate on the next slide. There are several analytical methods that have been developed to differentiate between perchlorate that's naturally occurring and man-made. One method is the stable isotope analysis of chlorine and oxygen and the perchlorate anion. Perchlorate that's naturally occurring is believed to have a unique isotope signature, which helps researchers distinguish it from perchlorate that's man-made. And I think I mentioned earlier, this is a topic of interest that the team has. This is also Paul Hapsinger, one of our trainers today, has done a lot of research in this area, and we do cover it in our document if you're interested in section 2.5. Slide 12. Indications are that perchlorate had limited use prior to World War II, and its most prevalent application was fireworks and railroad signal flares. But it's widely used today, and that's really because it's an exceptional oxidizer, it's stable, and it's safe to use. And it's used by industry extensively, including the medical industry, Department of Defense, Department of Energy, and NASA. Today, 90% of perchlorate is manufactured as ammonium perchlorate, as an oxidizing agent for solid rocket propellant and missiles. But there are many, many other uses of perchlorate. I've touched upon a couple of them already. Fireworks, safety flares, blasting agents, munitions, paints, enamels, matches, car airbags. The list goes on and on. In Appendix D of the first overview document, we provide a quite extensive list of current sources and uses and historical uses of perchlorate. Slide 19. As with other chemicals, it's really not surprising that past management practices have led to much of the groundwater perchlorate contamination. And in general, in the past, some of the management practices were inadequate to contain or prevent the release of perchlorate to the environment, really because perchlorate wasn't recognized or regarded as a contaminant concern. So the disposal methods that you see on the slide have proven to be the cause for many perchlorate contaminations. For example, open burn and open detonation, that was the principal disposal method for perchlorate waste material from rockets and missiles. The issue or the problem that resulted in many cases was perchlorate that wasn't burned to completion dissolved into the ground surface, being very soluble and very mobile, caused contamination. And that no longer occurs. However, I just want to mention, interesting enough, a couple years ago in Massachusetts, on a much smaller scale, of course, fireworks that were confiscated around the state were taken to training facilities, police training facilities. And they were detonated, and the contamination got into the ground surface above state standards, and now we have issues to address. So even though historical practices should no longer occur or they're being corrected when recognized, they have left a legacy of known and unknown sites. Slide 20. Even though there's growing awareness and improved management practices, current uses do continue to contribute to perchlorate contamination in the environment. And these sources that you see on slide 20, they may be small, but they can result in significant localized impacts. And that's really, again, because of perchlorate's unique properties of being very soluble, mobile, stable, and persistent. And I will highlight this issue when I talk about the first case study, which is the Merrimack River case study. Slide 21. There are two reasons why we're finding perchlorate in more places than we had expected. One reason is we now know where to look for it, and we're looking for it more often. But the bigger reason is we have improved analytical methodologies, and we can detect perchlorate at lower levels. And currently, analytical methodologies are able to detect as low as 0.02 micrograms per liter, or ppb, in drinking water. And there's two methods that can accomplish this. The first method is the EPA method 332, which is the ICMS method, the ion chromatography with tandem mass spectrometry. And the second method is EPA method 331, which is the LCMS method, which is liquid chromatography with tandem mass spectrometry. And table 2.4 of our overview document provides a nice comparison of all the methods, including advantages, disadvantages, and target reporting limits. And what we're doing in Massachusetts, our public water suppliers are required to test on a certain basis public water supplies, and they're using method 314, but if there's detections, and we did have a couple over this summer, they're required to use method 331 or 332 for that definitive quantification. So that concludes the background discussion. I tried to keep it brief. I realized I could go on and on. There's a really lot to tell regarding perchlorate, but we really do want to focus our time today, or the rest of our time today, on the technologies. So with that, Bruce Robinson, who's an IPRC stakeholder, is going to get us started, and he's going to talk about considerations for treatment selection. Bruce?
Thank you. Good morning. Rose, thank you for the overview of perchlorate issues and the introduction to the perchlorate remediation tech reg document. Slide 22. Now let's discuss treatment selection considerations. Section 3 of the tech reg document describes the feasibility study process and selection of remedial alternatives. Additionally, I'd like to suggest that you review the EPA 1988 Interim Final Guidance for Conducting Remedial Investigations and Feasibility Studies. It's an old document, but this is the treatise on the feasibility study process and is still used today. Steps for developing and screening alternatives are to establish remedial action objectives, develop a response action that will accomplish the remedial action objective, identify screening and screen appropriate technologies, select representative process options, then reevaluate your data needs and develop alternatives. The remedial action objective is a specific goal for how to accomplish the cleanup and protection of the environment, and the response actions are the specific measures of protection, such as containment or treatment, that will be taken to meet these remedial action objectives. Technology screening includes a review of the site characterization data to determine if there are technologies on the list that may not be effective. Slide 23, please. When developing the remedial action objectives described on slide 22, and your initial considerations include defining the remedial objective, determining the numerical cleanup standard, and deciding on a remediation time frame. It's important that there be buy-in on these considerations by all parties, including community members, business, regulators, and the responsible parties. During this process, it will be necessary to determine which is more appropriate, an in-situ or an ex-situ type treatment. Slide 24, please. The remedial action categories are the no action alternative, no further action, the land use controls, engineering controls, which would be containment, in-situ mass removal, and ex-situ mass removal. Land use controls include both engineering controls and institutional controls. Engineering controls implement a physical containment or isolation of the contaminant to limit the exposure. Engineering controls include things like groundwater pumping for plume containment or physical capping of a landfill with an inert non-permeable surface. Institutional controls include restrictive covenants that run with the land deed in perpetuity. An example may be a restriction to the deed that prevents the property from being used as a preschool. Slide 25. Examples of federal regulations for consideration in the applicable or relevant and appropriate requirements process include the National Oil and Hazardous Substances Contingency Plan of 1968 and the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act of 1980, known as Superfund. The NCP was developed to establish a national expectation for environmental quality, and CERCLA was then developed to codify the regulations associated with those expectations. So, for more information regarding the regulatory amendments, the CERCLA, or a more in-depth definition, please go to the EPA website and search NCP or Superfund. Slide 26, please. Regional applicable or relevant and appropriate requirements will include state, county, municipal, and tribal code. So after researching the regional regulations, develop a matrix of errors and evaluate which regulations or programs take precedence. Don't overlook your state agency as a source for compiling this information. They've repeated that process many times. Okay, this is a great photo. I think you're going to see this later. But this is the Tronox fluidized bed reactor in Henderson, Nevada, and it's a good example of the regulatory issues associated with technology. The permitting requirements for this facility include the following seven permit types. They had to acquire a Nevada water appropriations permit. In Nevada, any person planning on a new or additional development for beneficial use of water must obtain a permit to appropriate public water. They also had to have a national pollutant discharge elimination system permit to discharge the treated effluent back into the wash. An underground injection control permit was obtained to inject amendments into the subsurface for in situ bioremediation. Nevada has what's called a rolling stock permit. It's a permit application required by the Nevada DEP when conducting work within a waterway. It's a temporary permit issued for a maximum of 6 months. Tronox acquired air quality permits, including volatile and dust control permits associated with the storage of amendments and the treatment systems. Also required a Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms tax reporting permit for the use of denatured alcohol ethanol as an electron donor. And finally, they needed a RCRA permit for the handling, the waste handling and spent resin disposal. Slide 28, please. So, very important. We all know this now. 25 years ago, it was a less prevalent thing, but now you need to have involvement of stakeholders. It's imperative. So please incorporate your stakeholders into the project early in the remedial investigation process so that they're well informed prior to assisting with the selection of the alternatives. It's important to expose the public to details of the site investigation, including the size, extent, type of constituents, and the fate and transport. This information is essential for the stakeholder in assisting in the remedy selection process and providing good input. Stakeholders will be concerned about how their lives are going to be impacted by noise, safety, traffic, exposure to contaminants, and the effect on property values. Stakeholders will want to be included in deciding cleanup goals and remediation timeframes. These issues are paramount to determining the life cycle and cost of the site cleanup. Okay, at this point, it's my honor to turn this discussion over to Bob Barnwell of the Alabama Department of Environmental Management, and he's going to be describing the physical processes for water remediation. Bob?
All right, Bruce. And here on slide 29, we have the remediation technologies. Now, Rose and Bruce have touched on perchloric concerns that can lead to the need for an investigation. But even if you're in a state that does not have a promulgated action level, the risk numbers are available to determine if remediation is needed. Now, there are perchlorate remediation technologies that use physical and biological processes. Many of these technologies were developed in the past, mainly for water treatment, but they've been customized to address perchlorate issues. Now, these remedial technologies focus on all media except for air. There's no soil vapor risk. Perchlorate is not volatile. It's an inorganic. So I'll be talking about the physical processes to treat water, and that includes primarily ion exchange and carbon adsorption. Dr. Hassinger, he'll be talking about biological treatments. Now, these are slides on in-situ technologies for groundwater, but there's also slides on ex-situ technologies, too, like bioreactors. And Paul's done a lot of field work on this to provide the data, so he'll have some good information. And later, I'll come back online and discuss soil treatment technologies, and that includes in-situ bioremediations, getting those amendments into the soil, ex-situ bio, like composting, and thermal treatment, incineration. Then I'll finish up with some slides on phytoremediation. So let's move to slide 30. Now, the physical treatment processes are technologies that remove perchlorate from impacted water, but it doesn't destroy it. You still have disposal needs. Now, some technologies are proven and commercially available, while others are still in the research and development phase. Now, as the need for perchlorate remediation became apparent, these physical processes were the first considerations. Ion exchange is the most widely used physical technology, so it'll be discussed on a handful of slides. Carbon adsorption is also at full scale, and we'll have a couple of slides on that. Now, discussion on the remaining physical technologies will be brief. There's more detail that you can find in the ITRC Tech Reg document, Remediation Technologies for Perchlorate Contamination. Now, here are a couple of slides, the pictures of that perchlorate. One is a container of potassium perchlorate. I found that on eBay. It shows you how readily available it is. And the other one is that Mars rover. I think that was a couple of years ago. That sampled the soil and found perchlorate in deposits up there. So, gosh, on eBay, you can find it on even on Mars and naturally occurring. But since this widespread occurrence of perchlorate is becoming more evident, and these health concerns have been identified, you know, a variety of remedial technologies are needed so that we can have options to choose from. Let's go to slide 31. Now, ion exchange, once again, is the most proven and widely accepted physical process technology. And that will meet the existing perchlorate treatment goals, especially for drinking water. Now, during ion exchange, the perchlorate, which is that negatively charged ion, the anion, is exchanged with another anion, typically a chloride. Now, the exchange takes place on the resins. When the perchlorate impacted water flows through the resins, the perchlorate anions attach to those resins and the bound chloride ions are released. There's many different types of resins that are commercially available, and they can be made synthetically or from natural materials. Now, here are two photos showing ion exchange systems, and they can be operated as a single-use system with disposable resins or as a regenerable system with reusable resins. Now, most systems out there are single-use. However, these new technologies is providing a way to get more efficient and regenerable systems put to work. But for some more system-specific information like influent or effluent, you can go to one of the table 5-3, I believe, it's in that ITRC perchlorate tech reg document. Let's move to slide 32. Now, this flowchart is a diagram showing both options. Now, it looks a little busy, but you can see the main point. And once again, the single-use system is the most widely used. That's primarily due to the increase in efficiency of those perchlorate selective resins. That's that option 2 down there. Now, here, contaminated water is pumped through one or more vessels or columns, and that holds the resin, and this is where the ion exchange takes place. A vessel can contain millions of these small resin beads that form the resin bed. You'll have multiple vessels are often run in a series, like a lead lag configuration. And that ensures the water exiting the process is treated good enough and the breakthrough does not occur. And over time, the resin becomes saturated with the perchlorate and other competing ions, and that maxes out its ability to exchange anymore, and this is when you have that breakthrough. And you don't want perchlorate in the effluent. Now, the vessel is then taken out of service, and the resin must be disposed of, like by incineration. Fresh resin is then replaced back in the vessel and put back online. Now, a regenerable system, they haven't been used as much at full scale in the past few years. But here, the ion exchange capacity of resins is used up, then that column is taken offline so that the resin can be regenerating using a solution to displace those adsorbed perchlorate ions like you're washing it. The regeneration process includes backwashing, then regenerating with a solution, then followed by another rinse. There's a couple of types of regenerable designs. There's a fixed bed and a moving bed system. In the fixed bed design, the vessel setup is like the single-use system in a lead lag design. But once those resins are full of perchlorate, they must be treated either on or off-site, then reloaded back into the vessels. Now, a moving bed system was designed to handle more of the higher flow rates and the higher concentrations. This design uses beds mounting on a rotating carousel that are shuffled around to treat the water. Now, this was supposed to reduce the amount of chemicals needed for regeneration, but it didn't quite work well on perchlorate due to the variable water quality, lots of mechanical parts, and mainly the brine issue. Let's go to slide 33. The ion exchange resins, this is where it happens. Now, for perchlorate treatment, you can use either strong or weak base resins or a bifunctional resin. Now, these strong base resins are highly ionized and can be used over the entire pH range. Weak base resins are more sensitive to the pH. Now, resins have an order of preference for anion removal. The first exchange is on a nitrate, then you get the perchlorate, and then after that you have to get some sulfates. So getting a resin selective upper chlorate is important for efficiency. The single-use resins are disposable and primarily strong-base. Now, newer resin designs take advantage of even greater selectivity for chlorate. There's less attraction for those other anions, and that makes it possible for these systems to operate for a longer time. The use and disposal of single-use resin avoids the hassles and the liabilities associated with the brine that's produced during resin regeneration. The Oak Ridge National Lab, they developed a bifunctional resin. Those are highly selective for getting perchlorate out of water. The trademark is Biquat. I think Purolite puts those out. Now, this resin is very effective in removing even trace quantities of perchlorate in groundwater while also managing large volumes of water. So the bifunctional main comes from the resins having two functional groups that work together rather than one group, which is typical in most other resins. So in other words, you get a fast exchange and a high selectivity. Now, as ion exchange is not a destructive process, that perchlorate-laden spent resin produced from single-use system requires proper handling and disposal. So the resins can be sent to an approved landfill, but mainly disposed of by incineration. And that's better yet, because you get these waste energy disposal facilities, and they love these resins because they really give off good BTUs for that garbage incineration plants. Look at some of the regenerable resins. Now, they're reusable, but they produce a brine that requires disposal. The resins also need a national standard certification for drinking water applications. And also, that regenerate solution needs certification for drinking water. I think there's a system in La Puente, California. It's the only system I can think of that has this. Now, the weak base perchlorate selective anion resins, unlike the strong ones, they're dependent on pH. So at a low pH, the functional group is ionized to exchange those anions. You got a pre-treatment step to lower the pH prior to the ion exchange, and you have to have a post-treatment to restore the pH. Now, once the resin is spent, regeneration is accomplished by increasing the pH and neutralizing that functional group. Now, this enables an efficient regeneration that produces a much lower volume of spent regenerate solution compared to the stronger base resins. Now, perchlorate in the spent regenerate solution is then biodegraded or scavenged off prior to discharging. I believe the company Applied Research, Zed Coppola, Andrea Davis have done some good work on that one. Now, strong base regenerable resins, there are available and they're getting more consideration. The Oak Ridge Lab developed a new regenerant. I think it's tetrachloroferrate. Now, this is formed in an acid solution that was found to effectively displace that perchlorate that was adsorbed on the strong base resins. This regeneration efficiency is a better recovery and minimizes that brine waste. But no matter what, no matter how efficient, you still have that need for brine disposal, either by destruction, disposal, or recovery. You can even incinerate it. That does destroy it. Neutralize it and dispose of as hazardous waste. They used to have brine lines that even float into the oceans, but you needed a UIC permit, so there's not much of this. You can recover it as a pure perchlorate salt, or you can also give it some biological treatment. Let's go to slide 34. So in summary, the municipal drinking water supply impacted with the perchlorate, ion exchange is the key technology working today. The single-use system is the main one. They are in full-scale operation at sites in Arizona, California, Massachusetts, and in Texas. Massachusetts has the military reservation out there, and they've got four systems running. I think they've been running for 4 or 5 years now. They're single-use systems, and they do have the resins, the ion exchange resins get landfilled. They also have granular activated carbon that kind of polishes the system, but they've been able to reduce 50-60% of the perchlorate that's in the water, so it has been an effective system. There is regulatory acceptance, and the cleanup goals are being achieved. Now, there's other technologies at full scale, like that carbon, or biological, but they're not being used for drinking water applications. These technologies have processes that are just not yet certified for the drinking water use. Now, bio does seem very viable for treating impacted groundwater, but that groundwater is not discharged for public drinking. You still need all those certifications. Design considerations, you got to know your regulatory cleanup goal that defines that objective. Understanding the impact of the competing anions on resin capacity is essential. Now, system design should allow for expected seasonal changes in water quality, and sometimes you'll have high total dissolved solids that will require more O&M. Water is different everywhere. So it treats a range of perchlorate concentrations. A system will require more resin, O&M, when you get those concentrations that are over 100 parts per billion. But the ion exchange system also works good if you have a TC problem coupled with it. You can combine that system along with an air stripper system and handle both the TCE and the perchlorate. Then your decision is on single or regenerable. Now, the perchlorate selective resins make systems more efficient. And this is a key reason for using that single-use system, as well as the fact that those resin prices have fallen considerably during the past few years. So better selective resin removes perchlorate more efficiently and saves time and money. But those single-use resins require disposal. Now, regenerable resins, they create a brine. So the brine waste and spent regenerate solution require disposal, too. Capital costs for system design, installation, and O&M, they're dependent on site conditions and those cleanup goals. So you will spend less capital costs on a single-use system, which is less mechanics, but you'll spend more on replacing those spent resins. So the ion exchange holy grail, that would be having a regenerate resin with no brine issue. Let's go to slide 35. It's another system here. You have your granular carbon, and that's manufactured from a high carbon content material such as coal, wood, or even coconut shells. But there's a minimal adsorption capacity, so you have to activate it. When you have granular activated heated carbon, that's called GAC, GAC. And that produces more surface area for those contaminants to adsorb to. So part of the surface area is positively charged. And this surface area attracts those negatively charged contaminants like perchlorate. However, because that positively charged surface area of standard carbon is limited, using a standard GAC is not very effective in removing high concentrations of perchlorate. It's okay as a polishing, but for addressing low perchlorate levels. Now remember, perchlorate is highly water soluble. So therefore you can take the GAC, since it's not as efficient as treating the high-level perchlorates. But the absorptive capacity may be increased up to 40% through coating that surface. And that's known as tailoring the GAC, TGAC. This creates more surface area, more of the pore space. So to tailor the GAC, you have to preload it with an acid surfactant into a vessel. And when it's spent, most of that GAC's original adsorption capacity can be restored by chemically regenerating it with a basic solution. Or it can be thermally regenerated that burn off the perchlorate. Now, this method is a little different because tailoring actually works like an ion exchange type process. The perchlorate is absorbed and a chloride is released. So it's not just an adsorbent process typical of a GAC. There are some regulatory concerns. You've got discharge problems due to the surfactant not being certified. TGAC works good, but you may have to capture any of that surfactant that desorbs with the vessel. But if it gets certification for drinking water, then it could have more full-scale carbon systems out there. Slide 36. Some advantages here. Now, it's a proven technology with supporting data that has been placed in full-scale operation. But it's mainly tried full-scale because a system was already out there in place for other purposes. And that carbon material can be regenerated for reuse. The tailoring does make it very perchlorate selective. And it can also treat VOCs and explosives. Some disadvantages, though, it's less effective when you get those concentrations that are high, over 100 parts per billion. It's not destructive, so carbon regeneration does produce a waste. Water quality, that affects the efficiency and causes quicker breakthrough. The presence of competing ions, like the nitrates and sulfates, and those higher concentrations of perchlorate, that's going to result in a faster breakthrough time, and that's going to drive up those O&M costs. And you also have pretreatment and backwash requirements. Tailoring agents not yet certified for drinking water. The tailoring helps adsorb perchlorate, but it minimizes the absorption of the other contaminants. Let's go to slide 37. Another process here, membrane filtration. Bench scale testing has been done. There's no full-scale systems that I know of to date. Reverse osmosis, now that's a membrane filtration technology where water is demineralized through a membrane operating at a high pressure. Now, RO has long been used to remove ions from drinking water supplies. And when water containing perchlorate is driven under the high pressure through that semipermeable membrane, it does not allow the contaminants like perchlorate with a molecular size greater than the membrane to pass through it. So purified water passes through the membrane into a freshwater section, leaving that perchlorate-laden brine solution in the back. There are some home systems available. There is a national standard, I believe it's standard 58, that covers reverse osmosis systems for perchlorate. However, there are higher energy requirements, especially for a big system, and certainly those home maintenance needs for water, the water filter hassles. Anybody's had a home filtration system, that was a pain having to change those filters all the time. Now, reverse osmosis membrane side is finer than the perchlorate ion, so it gets filtered out. Now, it is good as a pre-treatment or a polish for a treatment train, and it works well with bioreactors, GAC, or even ion exchange, but you still have the fouling and those post-treatment concerns. Also, brine concerns. Yeah, liquid in that freshwater section can be used or discharged, but that brine solution requires further treatment or some appropriate disposal. Let's go to slide 38. Innovative and emerging technologies. Now, they've gone through bench-scale lab studies, too. You've got nanofiltration. That's another membrane system that preferentially separates the fluids under a low pressure. It's not as fine a filtration as RO, but it doesn't require as much energy either. But that membrane size is about the size of the perchlorate, so sometimes you get it and sometimes you don't. The electrodialysis, and that's a type of membrane treatment technology also that uses an electrical current. Now, that removes the perchlorate. You've got an electrodialysis cell that consists of a feed compartment and a brine compartment. It separates the anions and the cations. Fouling problems do decrease the efficiency, and is also pre-treatment required, and also the disposal issues there, too. Another technology is a capacitive deionization. Now, that's an electrochemical technology that separates the ions from solution using an electrical field. I think it was patented by the Lawrence Livermore National Lab back in 95. That's where the negative electrode will attract the positively charged ions, such as calcium, magnesium, while that positively charged electrode attracts the negative ones, like the perchlorate. You have a system also, electrolysis. Now, this is the process of decomposing an electrolyte solution into positive and negative ions using the electricity. And during the process, the electricity splits up the water being treated into its atomic parts, hydrolysis, and then the perchlorate is then reduced. I believe electrolysis is also used to generate perchlorate through chloride salts. Another system is the ultraviolet laser reduction. Now, it uses photons that can provide the activation energy, you radiate it, necessary for some molecules and water solutions like perchlorate to react. Now, this is good on lower levels, kind of breaks it down. Now, you can also couple this with zero valent iron. Tests have shown that perchlorate can be reduced by the metallic iron, and that UV light accelerates the reaction rate to levels that can make the process work even at full scale. Nanoscale bimetallic particles, large surface areas, high surface reactivity. This does provide a lot of flexibility for in situ applications. You can inject it into the treatment zones. You have titanium ions. That reduces the perchlorate ions in acid solutions, but that reaction is pretty slow. And this process may be suitable for perchlorate destruction in conditions of high acidity or high salt, for which biological remediation may not work. You also have a hydrogen gas membrane, and that works to filter the perchlorate from water. These membranes can work. They do work well with continuous flow bioreactors. It's like a little biofilm. Now, I didn't do all these technologies justice due to the time, but more detail can be found in the ITRC Tech Rig document that remediation technologies for perchlorate contamination. So in summary, the ion exchange is the technology most used, and it's getting better. Now, remediation by carbon could be considered either as a standalone system, or at least in conjunction with the ion exchange. Reverse osmosis appears to be helpful as part of the treatment train also, or as a point of use system for a home. Now, let's go to slide 39. This is going to be the first question and answer session. With this, I'll turn it back over to our moderator, Juliana in North Carolina.
Thank you, Bob. On slide 39, we are going to take a short break now for questions. For our simulcast participants, you can send in questions using the orange question mark button at the top of the slides. For our phone line participants, you're welcome to ask your own questions out loud. It is #6 to unmute your phone. So it was *6 to mute, and it's #6 to unmute. And when you ask a question, please state your name, location, and you're welcome to refer to a slide number if you'd like.
Juliana, this is Bruce Robinson. Could I just interject a real quick point?
Yes.
I just would like the participants to appreciate how happy the instructors are today, because, you know, when we started this, we really didn't realize it was going to evolve into a three-year process and that we'd be providing training for 3 years. But just so the group understands, the instructors have trained over 900 people related to perchlorate remediation technology. In the first tech reg document, approximately 1,290 folks were trained. So it's an amazing impact. The ITRC is a very worthwhile organization, and I would strongly encourage any and all people on the call to try to get an opportunity to participate. Thank you.
Thank you. More information about ITRC is available on the ITRC website, which is www.itrcweb.org. And each year, ITRC starts new teams, and then teams continue from previous years. So if you go to the ITRC website, you can not only learn about things that are already available, you can learn about new projects that ITRC is working on. So I do encourage you to go visit that website and see how you can become more involved with ITRC. Do we have any questions from our phone line audience? We have a simulcast question from Carl DuPault at Green Building Solutions and Supplies in Edgemont, Pennsylvania. He says it's a great presentation and he did not realize perchlorate was so widespread in the environment. He asks, what are the relative costs of some of the remediation technologies and how practical are they?
Hey, Paul, if you're there, you may want to speak up on some of the costs associated with this from some of your research. I know on the regulatory side here, I'm aware of the systems, but I haven't been privy to all the budgets associated with it. But, hey, these things run for a while, so efficiency is a big thing, especially when you're treating drinking water.
Yeah, I will address that a little bit later, but the treatments are very practical. There's a lot of full-scale systems running for water in particular, and there have been some very successful soil remediation projects, so there's no issue of practicality with any of these types of approaches. And in terms of, you know, water treatment, you know, the price varies somewhat based upon the approach applied. And I'll get to one slide as part of the biological where I show you a graph that kind of gives you at least some rough estimates for treatment, but a lot of that has to do also with, you know, what the end use of the water is, whether you're ultimately going to drinking water or reinjecting back into groundwater. And there's probably less good information on treatment costs for soils. There's not quite as much of that work done. But certainly there's practical approaches and they've been widely applied.
Juliana, this is Bruce Robinson. I think generally what we can say about remediation costs is that the more water that you have to move from an engineering process perspective, the higher the costs are going to be. So, you know, if you can use biobarriers and bioreactive processes in the ground to treat groundwater, you probably are going to reduce the overall cost of remediation. However, you know, your ability to treat higher concentrations is going to be more limited than it would be if you're doing an ex situ above ground treatment.
We'll go ahead then and continue on with the second half of our presentation. We do have another question and answer break, so if we haven't given you enough time to send in your question this time, you're welcome to go ahead and send that in, and we'll try to get that to that in the second half of today's training. If you have taken your phone off of mute, it's *6 to mute, and we'll remind you again, #6 to unmute at the next question and answer break. Continuing on with the second half of our presentation, please move to slide 40, and I'll now turn today's presentation over to Paul Hatzinger at Shaw Environmental. Paul?
Thanks, Liana. So we're now on slide 40, and what I'd like to cover in my section is both in-situ biological treatment as well as the application of ex-situ bioreactors for perchlorate treatment. So now moving to slide 41. There are a lot of different bacteria in the environment that are very common, and they're very widely distributed, and these organisms reduce perchlorate. And if we look at the graphic on the lower right, perchlorate, ClO4- is reduced by these bacteria to chlorate and then chlorite within the cell, and then the organisms release chloride and ultimately water. So you take perchlorate to two innocuous products. Now, these organisms require some type of generally organic substrate or carbon source to do this, and that carbon source is oxidized to produce cell biomass and carbon dioxide. And there's many different types of carbon sources that will support this activity, and I'll discuss that a little bit further. In the photo in the lower left is an organism that was isolated from groundwater underneath jet propulsion labs and has been extensively studied for its ability to degrade perchlorate. We go to slide 42. Now, perchlorate biodegradation occurs under mildly reducing conditions after denitrification but before sulfate reduction. So if you have either a bioreactor or an in-situ system and you add a carbon source or substrate, what you generally see is at high ORP, you see aerobic respiration, so all of the oxygen is broken down, then denitrification, so your nitrate will go. And it's generally after denitrification or concurrently with denitrification that you'll see perchlorate reduction. And usually by the time you start seeing sulfate reduction or methanogenesis, all of your perchlorate is biodegraded. And this is important in system design or looking at in-situ treatment because you have to add enough carbon source to treat oxygen, nitrate, and perchlorate. And often in many of the aquifers that have perchlorate, there can be very, very high concentrations of nitrate, often 2, 3, or 4 orders of magnitude higher than what's actually there in terms of perchlorate. So if we go to slide 43, then really in-situ bioremediation entails addition of a suitable carbon source. Your perchlorate-reducing bacteria are generally there. You don't have to bio-augment with an exogenous culture. And there's kind of two basic amendment strategies to get these carbon sources in the ground. And they include mobile systems. So that's generally where you mix a soluble substrate with water and use a recirculation design to mix. And then fixed biobarriers where you add slow-release substrates that are placed either with injection wells or sometime in trenches to create reactive barriers. And this is quite similar to some of the approaches that are used for things like chlorinated solvents. We go to slide 44. This is just a general example of a groundwater recirculation design. And if we look at the graphic on the right, you know, generally these will include one or more extraction wells. Water will be removed from the contaminated aquifer, amended with a carbon source, sometimes inorganic nutrients or buffer if it's a low pH aquifer, and then reinjected into the ground, creating a treatment or bioactive zone. Some of the soluble substrates that have been used at full scale include fatty acids like sodium lactate, benzoic acid, and citric acid, as well as ethanol. This can be a continuous pumping or a semi-continuous design where you really only utilize pumping to mix your substrate with contaminated water and then shut the system down. And there are various applications from source treatment to installing this type of system as a cutoff barrier. And at this point, there's a wide number of field tests that are complete. And these are some of these are listed in the ITRC document. I'll go through the results from one of those field tests and actually talk a little bit about a full-scale system at the former PEPCON site in Henderson, Nevada. So if we go to the next slide, number 45, this is just a brief description of a field demonstration that was conducted at the Indian Head Division Naval Surface Warfare Center, Indian Head, Maryland. And Indian Head is a site where they mix perchlorate to make fuels, and they also have what's known as a hog out facility. And perchlorate-containing fuels, after various periods of time in rockets or ejection seat motors, need to be replaced. And what's generally done is they use a wand to wash material out of casings and then save the casings. Usually that's recycled now or treated, but in the old days, that material was often, you know, washed out of buildings when people didn't realize that perchlorate could be an issue. So at the Indian Head site, they have a hog-out facility. Behind that facility, there's shallow groundwater that has a lot of perchlorate, generally from 50 to 250 parts per million in groundwater. It's also an acidic aquifer, so it's very low pH. And research has shown that at low pH, you know, in the mid-4s up to about 5, although perchlorate-reducing bacteria are present, sometimes they won't biodegrade perchlorate until the aquifer is buffered into the mid-5s. If you look at the photograph in the upper right, this is just a photo of the demonstration system. We have a plot in the forefront that included 2 extraction wells and 2 injection wells. Water was removed from the extraction wells continuously at about a gallon per minute to a skid where it was amended with lactate as the carbon source and a carbonate buffer, and then it was re-injected. So you created sort of an underground recirculation zone. And in the foreground, in the back, there's actually a whole test plot that wasn't treated with either buffer or the lactate, but where water was recirculated. And the results of this demonstration showed that over about a 15-week operational period, greater than 95% of perchlorate was removed in the test plot. There was no removal noted in the control plot in the back. 2 of the wells reached less than 5 ppb, and 3 of them were below 1 ppm at the conclusion of the 15 weeks. So this ended up being a very effective demonstration of an in-situ recirculation design for source area treatment. If we move to slide 46, there's also one good-sized full-scale mobile system. This is at the AMPAC, or former PEPCON site in Henderson, Nevada. This site produced ammonium perchlorate from 1958 until May 4th, 1988, when the facility exploded, as you see in the lower left. There's a lot of good video on YouTube. It's really a horrific explosion. I believe they had something on the order of 11 million tons of ammonium perchlorate on site when the facility exploded. The explosion has resulted in a groundwater plume, and this plume runs about 2 miles north from the facility toward the Las Vegas Wash. There's perchlorate down to about 350 feet, with concentrations ranging up to 600 ppm, at about 1 ppm down at the toe of the plume. And an in-situ system was installed in late 2006. If we look at the photo in the upper right, this included 9 extraction wells at the toe of the plume to cut off groundwater flow. The water was conveyed through about 5,000 feet of piping to an area where it's injected with sodium benzoate as a carbon source, and they use chlorine dioxide as an anti-fouling agent for the injection wells. The water is then re-injected. The intended flow for the system is between 250 and 350 GPM. And when all the water is blended, the influent perchlorate is somewhere, expected to be somewhere in the order of 10 to 12 ppm. Early results for the system showed declining perchlorate at the wells closest to the reinjection area. And as with all pumping systems, one of the issues with this type of system is just the significant amount of O&M that goes into keeping those injection wells open. And that's a consistent problem with these types of pumping systems. You have to plan for that in advance. So if we go to slide 47, the other basic approach for treatment, in-situ treatment, is fixed biobarriers. And in this case, slow-release substrates are used, and water is generally not pumped. And those types of substrates can include things like vegetable oil or emulsified oils, HRC, compost, cheese whey, all sorts of different materials. These can be source treatment areas or more frequently cutoff barrier designs. And again, there are a number of field tests complete, as well as one full-scale system. And if you look at the photo on the upper right, this is a trench barrier that was installed. I'll talk about that a little bit, the Naval Weapons Industrial Reserve plant in Texas. And you see materials, organic materials, being poured into that trench, which will be the carbon substrate for perchlorate reduction. Then the lower right, this is a group that's injecting emulsified oil as a barrier at a site in Elkton, Maryland, and I'll talk about that as an example next of an in-situ system, a pilot demonstration system. So on slide 48 then, that photo I showed on the previous slide is injection of an emulsified oil. This was done at a site in Elkton, Maryland. They had a surface impoundment that leached perchlorate, and it moved into shallow alluvium about 10 to 20 feet below ground surface. The perchlorate was at PPM levels. The site is neutral pH with about 80 to 150 feet a year of groundwater flow. And during this pilot study, 10 one-inch wells were put in, and they were 5 feet apart. And those are actually the blue points on the cartoon on the right, water flowing from the bottom to the top of the page. Approximately 11 gallons of EOS, emulsified oil substrate, was injected, followed by chase water, and then monitoring was done over a period of a couple of years. And the results showed that downgrading of the barrier, perchlorate was reduced to less than 4 ppb, and the photo on the upper right shows some of the data after 6 months, and you can see that perchlorate was non-detect downgrading of the barrier. Over a longer time frame, 111 TCA was also treated by the oil injection. And I actually was fortunate enough to go down there about 3 years later and do some isotope work, and the barrier was still functioning 3 years after injection of the oil, and perchlorate was non-detect downgrading of the barrier. So it was a nice long-term solution here, potentially to treat that perchlorate. On slide 49, another place where there's been quite a bit of work done is at the Naval Weapons Industrial Reserve plant in McGregor, Texas. And early on, into the mid-late 90s, they were looking at trench barriers to keep perchlorate from flowing off-site in shallow groundwater and runoff water. And they looked at various trench designs, which we see in the upper right, including some that had GAC, some with cottonseed meal as a carbon source for perchlorate reduction, other trenches that had compost. And they sort of chose a design which ultimately included mushroom compost, soybean oil-soaked wood chips, and aggregate. And over the past several years, they've actually installed now about 12,000 feet of trench down to as deep as 25 feet below ground surface, filled with these materials. And the results have shown very significant reductions in perchlorate downgrading of these trenches. And you can see one of the pilot trenches in the lower right, sort of before addition, and then after addition with groundwater flow from the lower right to the upper left portion of the page, and you can see the area of clearing where perchlorate is no longer within this plume due to the trench barrier. So this has been very, very effective and at a very large scale. So on to slide 50 then. Some of the strengths, as Bruce mentioned earlier, in situ tends to have lower capital costs. Contaminants are treated in situ. You're using natural perchlorate-reducing organisms to do this. The same type of approach is applicable for multiple co-contaminants, including many explosives and solvents. There's lots of configurations. Some of the disadvantages, you know, any in situ treatment system causes often secondary water quality issues. So if this is a drinking water aquifer, you have to be concerned about mobilization of iron, manganese, and arsenic. You know, sometimes you'll form sulfide and methane gas. You know, these issues usually resolve, but if you're close to a well, a receptor well, you have to be concerned about that. And for the active systems where you're pumping groundwater, you know, biofouling is an issue that's always of concern, and you have to think about that up front because any injection wells will tend to biofoul fairly quickly. So then on to slide 51, for the second half of my presentation, I'll talk a little bit about bioreactors. A number of bioreactor designs have been applied at full scale for treating perchlorate, and these include continuous flow stirred tank reactors, or CSTRs, and various types of fixed film designs, including fluidized bed reactors and packed bed reactors. And in the photos on this slide, you see a CSTR design in the lower right. That's at the ATK Thiokol facility in Brigham City, Utah, and it treats hog-out wastewater. And the reactor on the left is also at the McGregor plant, where we saw the trench barriers, and this is a fluidized bed reactor that treats groundwater on site. So then on to slide 52, where we'll talk about the CSTR reactors. And basically, this is a suspended growth system. And if we look at the photograph, essentially you have a tank of some type. It can be plastic or stainless. Bacteria grow in suspension within that tank, and often you have some type of mixing system, but water is fed to the tank, your perchlorate-contaminated water. There's a feed of a carbon source to the tank, which will feed the bacteria, sometimes inorganic nutrients, and then the treated water is removed after a residence time within the tank. For this type of design, it's most often applied to treat high-strength industrial wastewaters. It's very well suited for low flow streams, and it can treat a number of common contaminants, including nitrate and explosives. And there actually are two full-scale systems that have been installed. I showed you the one at ATK Thiokol on the previous photo. And if we go to slide 53, this is a system that was installed at the Pyrodex plant in Harrington, Kansas. They produce a type of gunpowder. And the wastewater from that operation has very high perchlorate and nitrate, in excess of, 3,000 ppm for perchlorate and 2,000 for nitrate. And the system was designed and built that includes two 2,500-gallon reactors. You see those on the right. It's a fairly simple system. Residence time is somewhere between 8 and 30 hours. The system flows at 3 gallons per minute, and it's fed desugared molasses as a substrate. The effluent is discharged to a POTW. And the system was originally designed and inoculated in 2003, and to my knowledge has run since that time, meeting its regulatory objectives. And the treatment costs are somewhere in the order of $10 per 1,000 gallons of high-strength wastewater treated, which was reasonably inexpensive compared to other options for treating this water. Now, if we go to slide 54, a second design that's been widely applied is the fluidized bed reactor, or FBR, and this uses a solid media, usually sand or granular activated carbon, to support bacteria to degrade perchlorate. And if you look at the graphic on the right, an FBR fairly simply is a large tank. It's full of either sand or GAC, and your influent water, your groundwater, is fed through a series of headers into the bottom of the tank. And that water is evenly distributed at an influent flow rate that will fluidize the bed, so the particles will look like they're danced or suspended in solution. And what you get by doing that is a very high surface area for bacterial growth, and that your perchlorate reducers grow as a film on the surface of those particles. As with other reactor designs, it'll be fed a carbon source, sometimes inorganic nutrients, and there's also a recycle component of these, so you can change the residence time somewhat. This design is applicable for a wide range of concentrations, from ppb to hundreds of ppm. As with the other designs, you can treat nitrate, chlorate, and some explosives, as well as usually the residence time is not long enough for solvents, but you definitely treat nitrate and chlorate in these, as well as RDX and TNT. Interestingly, this design is permittable for drinking water treatment in California, and there is a large-scale drinking water plant that's scheduled to be installed near Rialto, California, that will include a biological drinking water component. And other than that, there are actually 5 full-scale systems in operation right now, the first of which was built in the late 1990s at Aerojet in Sacramento, and is still in operation today at 5,000 gallons per minute. If you go to the next slide, this is perhaps the largest system in terms of system components. And this is a system in Henderson, Nevada. It's at the what's now known as the Tronox facility. It was formerly Kerr-McGee. This plant is right next door to the AMPAC facility, where the in-situ treatment system has been constructed. And this includes now a total of 9 reactors. And if you look at the photograph, you see a series of vessels. The first, third, fourth, and sixth are actually fluid bed reactors. That set are filled with sand. They're 14 feet in diameter, 26 feet tall. And if you look at the second and, I guess, the second and fifth, those are biomass separators. So biomass that exits the top of this reactor gets separated out from the effluent water. There's a whole second bank of reactors behind these. They're sort of a mirror image, basically, and those are carbon reactors. That is, they're the same fluid beds, but they have carbon rather than sand. So basically, this first bank of reactors removes perchlorate, most of the perchlorate, all of the nitrate, and a whole bunch of chlorate. So these first reactors really are treating, nitrate up to 50 or 60 ppm, a couple hundred ppm of chlorate, and most of the perchlorate. And then the carbon reactors kind of polish the perchlorate down to less than 4 ppb. The water is discharged into the Las Vegas wash. And this system treats on the order of 400 tons of perchlorate per year. And the impact of both this in-situ and ex-situ system are really significant because the perchlorate going into the Las Vegas Wash and Lake Mead has been reduced by well over 90%. And if one looks down gradient in the Colorado River in Arizona, in 1999 they were detecting perchlorate concentrations nearly 10 ppb all the way down in Arizona from Lake Mead. And in 2008 they rarely see detectable concentrations, and the highest concentrations they ever see are less than 2 ppb. So, you know, treating this water that's coming from these facilities has had a huge impact on perchlorate in the lower Colorado, which was one of the original issues that caused perchlorate to come to the forefront. The other type of design are packed bed reactors on slide 56. These are like a fluid bed, except the media is not fluidized. You use larger particles. Water flows up through the reactor, and it's treated with much like with the fluid beds. It's a nice, simple design. There's been extensive pilot testing that's been very effective. As with fluid beds, this type of technology is permittable for drinking water treatment in California, and I know there are various companies that are pursuing installation of full-scale systems. The one system that I know of that's gone in actually doesn't treat water, but it treats the rejectate from an electrodialysis system. So Bob Barnwell spoke a little about emerging technologies, and the city of Magna, Utah, has put in an electrodialysis system basically to remove other contaminants, but it also removes perchlorate. And in conjunction with that, they're using a packed bed reactor design to treat the rejectate water that has perchlorate before it gets discharged. So it's kind of a novel use of a packed bed, but a new full-scale application for that type of system. So the question came up of treatment costs. On slide 57, we see one example of treatment costs. And this was some work that was done when a system was being spec'd out for the Jet Propulsion Labs at NASA. And this work was done by an independent consultant. And essentially, what you see when you look at the graph, if you have treatment costs in acre feet versus influent perchlorate, you see that for ion exchange, it's generally cheaper at very low perchlorate concentrations than a biological system. And the prices of regenerable resins have continued to come down with time. But as perchlorate concentration increases, you have a very steep cost slope here because you have to change out the resin more and more frequently, and that's really what drives your cost for this type of system. Now, with a biological system, you can see as perchlorate concentration increases, particularly into the hundreds of ppb to ppm range, you know, the biological systems are very cost effective because there's almost no increase in treatment costs. You just add a little more carbon source, and that's usually fairly inexpensive. So in conclusion, on slide 58, I think the thing to take from this is there are full-scale technologies available for perchlorate treatment in water. They're widely applied. Some have been applied for more than a decade. And the type of approach you use is really based upon, you know, your considerations of the use of the water, what the characteristics look like, and ultimately, you know, what the cost of the different approaches will be. So now if you move into slide 59, I'm going to turn this back over to Bob Barnwell, who's going to discuss biological treatment of soils.
Hey, Paul, thanks. It's good to hear that a lot of the biological treatments are getting that drinking water certification, so that's opening up the options, and we got some success stories out there. On a biological note, too, at the Aerojet, they're doing some column studies on with just limestone and sulfur. I think they're going to put that on a pilot scale out there. At Aerojet, too, it's kind of low technology, but they're, you know, looking at different things biologically to treat the water. Slide 59. Now, Paul's talked about biotreatment in water, so now let's take a look at bio in the soil. And I begin talking about biotreatment of soil at the source. So we need a good site characterization to identify suspect source areas. Now, because perchlorate is extremely soluble in water, precipitation may quickly reduce the contaminant mass present in the soils. There's a low affinity. So soil delineation is important. Now remember, the perchlorate doesn't stick to soil very well, so you don't want to stop delineating at the surface. Now here in the southeast, we have a lot of humidity, so that provides enough moisture when you wouldn't normally have an accumulation like you would out in Texas or in desert areas. But you can't have paved surface areas, storage pads or foundations that block that precipitation from flushing through the soil. And also you may have some binding agents, and those are associated with rocket propellants, and that can keep the perchlorate sticking around in the soil too. But once it gets in the groundwater, it can stick around for years. Now, perchlorate remaining in the vado zone may represent a continuing source of perchloric contamination to the groundwater. So therefore, a source area treatment should be part of a remedial alternative. So let's look at some microbe technologies. There's in situ and ex situ approaches for soil. Now, perchlorate degrading organisms, they're widespread in the soils, and they appear to occur under a wide range of environmental conditions. So bioaugmentation does not appear to be needed. Just focus on the existing bugs. Now, similar to in situ bio for groundwater, you need a mildly reducing anaerobic environment, you know, and conduct a microcosm study. So find the most suitable substrate, the donor, the food, and find the nutrient balance. So you want to get that stoichiometric balance for the reaction to take place. And once you find the most appropriate mixture, then go after that delivery problem. Now, the key is the delivery with the right amendments. That's the right recipe to those problem areas. Let's go to slide 60. In situ treatment at the surface. Those addresses hot spots. Now, near surface contamination can generally be treated in place rather than being excavated. But without source treatment, that groundwater treatment for dissolved perchlorate may require operation for an indefinite time, and that's hard to fund a project when you don't have an endpoint. So at the surface, you can add amendments to facilitate the degradation. You got liquid amendments. Those are some carbon sources such as ethanol, molasses, or compost. Those have been tested. You can apply that by spraying on the ground. You can inject it at the surface or infiltrate into a collection area. At that Aerojet facility in California, soil washing with an anaerobic slurry, and that was made using saturated soils and a variety of electron donors. They tried a bunch of things. It was back to the ethanol, manure, food waste, vinegar, and molasses. I believe it took about a month to see any results, but then it really started to work. And tilling didn't even appear to make a difference at that location. Now, you have some solid amendments. Now, that can be applied as an overlay, then just add water. So solid amendments at the Aerojet, that included some manure overlays, and calcium magnesium acetate. Now, this anaerobic composting was used at perchlorate hotspots. The test showed that the perchlorate degraded in about a year or two, or degraded in a year by one or two orders of magnitude. And lab scale testing from this led to pilot testing in other areas. Bruce is going to come back online later, and he'll discuss this in a little more detail when he presents the Aerojet case study on the last slides. But now let's go to slide 61. A bigger challenge is the sites where that perchlorate remains in the deeper vado zone. Electron donors are often injected into the groundwater, so similar solutions can be directly applied to the vado zone. Application methods could include sprinkler irrigation or direct injection or periodic flooding through some infiltration galleries. Both liquid and solid amendments. And that can be applied and mixed in with surface soils, maybe the top 0 to 3 feet. And once mixed, they can be mobilized with water to greater depths to stimulate that perchlorate biodegradation. So this liquid nutrient amendments generally perform better at sites where the contamination is deep or the clay content is high. And this type of, and amount of soil amendments, the clay content and water application rate determine the biodegradation rate of the perchlorate. Now, the amendments can be mobilized down using that infiltration gallery or injection wells or just by regular surface watering. As mentioned earlier, these amendments can also be applied by using a direct push type rig. Now, that works better when you basically go to the bottom part and work your way from the bottom up rather than a top down. It just spreads better. You have some gas phase amendments. It's also called anaerobic bioventing. This is a good option for vado zone remediation because gases can disperse further into the unsaturated material rather than liquids. Now, however, these gas injections may cause the soil to lose moisture to levels that do not support biodegradation, so you'd have to be careful there. You have carrier gases like nitrogen, can be amended with a donor and injected into the soil to flush oxygen and enhance those anaerobic conditions. Radius of influence, and that's the key. You got to get those amendments to the problem areas. Slide 62. The lex situ treatment. This is composting. Organisms growing at high temperatures. You can manage the delivery of amendments while composting much easier than with in-situ treatment. The soils can be excavated, and you screen them to remove any rock and debris. Then the soil is then treated with water and the amendments in containment cells. Then those indigenous anaerobic bacteria, they reduce the perchlorate down to a chloride. The treatment can continue in a controlled environment, water is added, and samples can be collected for data to show success. Full-scale results demonstrate the perchlorate can be reduced within a one-month period. See, at the Longhorn ammunition plant, that's in Texas, the SM cells were divided to test various nutrient amendments, including some of the manures, cow and chicken manure, methanol, ethanol, acetate, molasses, and even cotton gin waste. Over at the McGregor Naval Plant, also in Texas, they used a citric acid as the carbon source, some nitrate and some phosphate fertilizers, kind of the micronutrients, and then a soda ash as a buffer. So we have some advantages and disadvantages. Short-term technology that can be used to treat localized hotspots and sore zones. The treatment costs may be less than conventional dig-and-haul approaches, but current research shows that the biological processes are most effective when that contaminant is in the upper foot and a half. You don't want something too thick. See, passive treatment methods are relatively simple and inexpensive because there's no required soil mixing. But those passive methods may not cover all the soils in a cell without some little mixing going on. So in summary, soil excavation and above-ground biological treatment allows for pre-treatment and better process control than in-situ bio. In soil, composting has been shown to reduce perchlorate in soil. Let's go to slide 63. Thermal treatment. Now, thermal treatment has been conducted as an ex-situ method. That thermal desorption system uses heat to separate the contaminants from the soil and then thermally destroys them. That thermal destruction uses kilns followed by an afterburner, kind of like a cement rotary kiln. And it can work to destroy those perchlorate impacted soils. You excavate the soils, then the rocks and other debris removed. Soil is fed into a rotating drum and heated to between, 600, 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And these high temperatures dry the soil, burn off any organic material, and then drive off the contaminants from the soil so that they can be caught in the exhaust or the off gas. Also at the Massachusetts Military Reservations, that MMR, they had a full-scale system there that ran for about 3 years. They had approximately 60,000 tons of soil, retreated down from 100 parts per million down to below the remediation goal of 4 parts per billion. That was during that full-scale operation. And these levels allow for the soil to be placed back on site without being a continued source area. Main advantage, complete destruction of the perchlorate. And it also treats co-contaminants as well because they also have to treat explosives there. So to be effective, you must achieve high soil temperature for a minimum residence time. Disadvantage, of course, would be getting the high temperature. It's a big energy requirement. It's expensive. Now, more detail on the thermal process is in our perchlorate tech reg, but there's also several other ITRC tech reg documents on thermal desorption. And these focus on a variety of the contaminants, and the process is much more clearly defined. Let's go to slide 64. Phytoremediation. Now, this is a treatment technology that uses natural plant processes and the microorganisms associated with the root system to remove, contain, or degrade contaminants in the soil, sediment, and water. Now, use of plants in their root zone associated bugs can either sequester or degrade the contaminants or a combination of the two processes. The main mechanism is the rhizodegradation, and that's at the roots. The root zone of plants can be engineered to biostimulate and enhance rapid rhizodegradation of the perchlorate. Accelerates the cleanup, minimizes the plant uptake of perchlorate into the leaf tissue, and the root system basically acts like a bioreactor. So the enhancement of rhizodegradation, that's achieved by providing carbon and electron donors to the root zone at planting or during the O&M phase. There is no secondary waste if the phytoremediation is engineered to enhance that rhizodegradation. And it has been demonstrated at full scale at a constructed treatment wetland at the Lawrence Livermore National Lab, that's out in California. But because uptake and phytodegradation is a slow process, it possesses eco-risk resulting from that phytoaccumulation of the perchlorate taken up and transported mainly to the plant leaves. Now, for example, phytoaccumulation has led to health concerns regarding perchlorate levels, and they found that in lettuce and other food crops that are irrigated with the perchlorate contaminated water.
the occurrence of perchlorate in dairy milk. It has to do in part to the cows feeding on the grass that was grown with that perchlorate contaminated soil and the water. Now, however, the degradation of perchlorate in the root zone of plants by perchlorate degrading bugs that can minimize the uptake and the potential accumulation in the plant tissue. Let's see here. We have some plants where testing has shown effectiveness. We have some cattails, some duckweed, black willow, parrot feather, eastern cottonwood. And it's been pilot tested at the Longhorn Ammunition Plant there for perchlorate. And they planted a bunch of poplars, that's the eastern cottonwood, on about a half-acre site. And perchlorate might have a toxic effect on certain species, though. Therefore, it's important to select a plant that's suitable for achieving the treatment goals. Slide 65. Advantages? Yeah, it's low cost. Phytotechnologies generally compare good with cost for above ground treatment technologies. There's a high public acceptance. You can have a controlled environment through constructed wetlands. And if the phytoremediation is engineered to enhance that rhizodegradation, you don't even have any secondary waste. You can also treat some common co-contaminants like VOCs or explosives. It could lead to some wetland banks or other site improvements. Disadvantages, well, the depth and the climate restrictions. Plant growth can be impacted, so you may need a variety during the treatment period. Now, testing has been done where deeper groundwater can be pumped up and used to water the plants in design systems. So in a controlled area, like a constructed wetland, the water can be applied at a proper rate for roots to utilize and work on the degradation process. But it is a relatively slow process. Still, phytoaccumulation can be a concern. The potential for transfer contaminants from soil and groundwater into the food chain, now you got an eco risk until it's degraded. Regulatory acceptance, I'm pretty good with it. But still, it's a new technology without a lot of cost and performance data. So it's difficult for managers to select and get approval for a phytoremediation of perchlorate. But there are several good ITRC tech rig documents, and that addresses phytoremediation and the wetland construction. I think there's a couple on phytotechnology and one on constructed wetlands itself. So in summary, right plants at the right place. There is data to show phytoremediation is a viable technology and can be a great part of a remedial alternatives. So now let's look at a couple of case studies. We're going to move to slide 66. And Rose is going to start off. She's going to discuss perchlorate concerns from a surface water intake north of Boston.
Thanks, Bob. So we're on slide 66. In August of 2004, the town of Tewksbury, Massachusetts, detected perchlorate above 1 part per billion in their town water supply. And at the time, a health advisory was in effect in Massachusetts, and that health advisory was 1 ppb. The town of Tewksbury draws its water supply from the Merrimack River, which is the second largest river in Massachusetts. The Merrimack is actually the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution in the 19th century. The detections in the river, they were during summer months in August, coincided with low flow concentrations in the river, so about 3,000 cubic feet per second. So after verifying the presence of perchlorate in the river, the Massachusetts DEP, the town of Tewksbury, and some of the other surrounding cities and towns began a multi-phase sampling program to determine the source. And the first phase of that program was to conduct ambient water sampling upstream and downstream of Tewksbury's water intake on the Merrimack, as well as ambient water sampling on the Concord River, which is a tributary just upstream from Tewksbury's water intake. At the same time, potential sources of perchlorate discharging to the Merrimack and the Concord Rivers were identified, mapped, and they were prioritized for sampling. It was surprising that we found a fair number of potential sources of perchlorate. They included a quarry, formerly used defense site, industrial manufacturing plants, areas along the river where blasting operations had occurred in recent years, fireworks displays, community-type fireworks displays that had occurred in the banks of the rivers, and there were three wastewater facilities that were identified, one on the Merrimack River and two on the Concord River. And the results of these phases of sampling led MassDEP to the town of Billerica's wastewater treatment plant. And that wastewater treatment plant is located on the Concord River 5 miles upstream of Tewksbury's water intake. So the next phase of sampling, the influent and the effluent of the wastewater plant, as well as the process, so prior to chlorination, was sampled. And the results indicated that perchlorate was present in both the influent and the effluent, and the concentrations ranged from tens of parts per billion to hundreds. And the maximum concentration of perchlorate detected in the effluent was 800 parts per billion. I briefly want to touch upon analytical methods used. It was a modified version of EPA method 314, which reliably detected down to one part per billion. That was used to analyze the ambient water samples. The concern with using this method for the wastewater samples was that method 314, can't provide definitive quantification and identification of the perchlorate ion due to potential matrix interferences. So an LC-MS method was used to analyze the wastewater samples as well as verification testing on the ambient water samples when there was a detection. And when you compared the LC-MS method versus the modified method 314 on the ambient water samples, there was a good correlation. Slide 67. Just want to show the location that we're talking about. The red star at the top of the page, that is Tewksbury's water intake. And so that's the Merrimack River flowing from left to right. You see three yellow stars. The top yellow star is Methuen's wastewater treatment plant. It's the middle two yellow stars. That's Billerica. That's the Concord River flowing from the south direction to the north direction. The top one is the town of Billerica, South Dakota Corrections wastewater treatment plant, which is very small. It's the bottom star. That's the that corresponds to the town of Billerica's wastewater treatment plant. That's a secondary plant. It services 50,000 people. Total average daily flow, 3.1 million gallons per day. About 0.4 of that is industrial wastewater flow. So at a concentration, a maximum concentration of 800 parts per billion detected, this equated to about 6 to 10 pounds per day of perchlorate being discharged from the plant into the Concord River. And that was consistent with the 2 to 4 parts per billion seen just downstream in the Concord River. And just for comparison, the average flow of the Concord River around that time is 300 cubic feet per second. That's about a tenth of the Merrimack River. So after detecting perchlorate in the influent to the wastewater treatment plant, the next step was for Mass DET and the town of Billerica to start looking at potential sources upstream of the plant discharging to the municipal system. There were about 40 potential sources identified, and they were prioritized for sampling. And this eventually led to the source. It was sole source, a manufacturer of surgical and medical instruments. Slide 68. The company uses perchloric acid, about 220 gallons per month, and although only a small percentage is discharged to the sewer, it equal to about 5 to 10 pounds per day of perchlorate. It's important to note that the company used a batch process, and that explains the variability and the spikes in the data that MassDET was seeing. The first step, I guess, was to try to eliminate the use of perchlorate and use something in its place. But because the process that the company uses is heavily regulated by the FDA, that wasn't possible. So then they agreed to treat their effluent prior to discharge to the wastewater treatment plant, and they're doing so by they implemented an ion exchange system. So they treat an effluent of approximately 2,000 milligrams per liter down to 0.05 milligrams per liter. The company chose ion exchange even with the expensive regeneration cost, really because they wanted to start treating very quickly. They did a number of pilot studies, gave that information or passed it to MassDEP. MassDEP, based on those pilot studies, imposed a 50 parts per billion treatment guideline. So they were able to get going and start treating quickly. They did consider other technologies, including biological treatment, but felt that it would have taken longer to implement, longer to treat, and in their particular case, they did have space limitations. So this system has been operating since 2005, and there really have not been any issues with the system itself. If you want more information on this case study, we did write up a sidebar in section 2 of our report, our overview report. If you want even more information, we developed, at MassDET, we developed a report on the sources and occurrence of perchlorate in the whole state from the years of, I think, 2004 to 2006. This is on the MassDET website, and Juliana also has that link, and she'll provide that information at the end of today's training. We selected this case study because we thought it was a really good example showing the effects of a relatively small source, which happens to be a non-military source, and the significant localized impacts. Now we're going to go to our second case study, and Bruce Robinson will make that presentation. He's going to talk about all the work that's been conducted at the Aerojet facility in Rancho Cordova, California. Bruce?
Thanks, Rose. And before I get started, I want to say that the Merrimack gas study that Rose presented is a fabulous example of the level of effort required to determine, in this situation, a sole source. that had a significant impact. So Aerojet is another fabulous case study, and one because it's going to highlight several of the remediation technologies that both Bob and Paul pointed out. This first photo gives you an idea of the surface at the Aerojet site, which was an early turn of the century mining for gold location where they used water cannons, and you can see the sinuous nature of the topography. So this case study will highlight four general types of groundwater treatment and two general types of soil treatment used at the site. Slide 70, please. Aerojet is located about 16 miles east of downtown Sacramento in Rancho Cordova. Aerojet is very interesting because of its location, its history, and as I said, the number of remediation technologies that were either applied at the site or developed at the site. Slide 71. Aerojet located in Rancho Cordova back in 1952. Aerojet conducted three general types of industrial activities. They did solid rocket manufacturing and testing, liquid rocket manufacturing and testing, and some limited chemical manufacturing. In 1982, Aerojet began remediation of TCE in groundwater plume that was using a pump and treat technology. Following treatment of the water, the water was re-injected down gradient of the plume to create a hydraulic barrier to contaminant transport. I remember back in the early 80s, this was a very popular process, and we were quite enamored by the opportunity to stop a plume movement. Unfortunately for Aerojet, there was a significant concentration of perchlorate in that water that they were using for the barrier. So in 1995, the EPA established a provisional reference dose for perchlorate, approximately 4 to 18 micrograms per liter in drinking water. At the time, the analytical detection limit for perchlorate was 400 micrograms per liter. So the resulting discrepancy between the reference dose and the detection limit fueled subsequent refinement of the analytical methods that were described by Rose today. Also in 1995, Aerojet detected the perchlorate down gradient of the groundwater injection field at approximately 8,000 micrograms per liter. So subsequently then in 1996, the California Regional Water Quality Control Board requested that Aerojet investigate the extent of the site plume and remediate the perchlorate in groundwater. Slide 71, or I'm sorry, how about slide 72? Aerojet is a fairly large site. It covers approximately 13,000 acres. So it has exposed bedrock on the eastern side of the plant site. So the Aerojet property causes groundwater to flow radially across the site, resulting in a flow of water to the north, south, and west. The groundwater aquifer beneath the property is a very important drinking water source for downgradient communities. 73. This figure depicts the horizontal extent of perchlorate concentrations within the project area, and that's that green border. So I like to point out that the isolated area of contamination located over the American River, where the perchlorate plume has actually migrated beyond the hydraulic barrier created by the river. That's pretty unusual. Along the southern extent of the map, you can see the former 400-acre McDonnell Douglas parcel. That's the IRCTS. And the former downhole testing facility. These locations represent sources of perchlorate that were not owned and operated by Aerojet. Say, on this map, manufacturing lines are highlighted by a number. These are areas of manufacturing included the use of solvents and copious amounts of water to clean the castings and wash down the facilities. Water and spent solvents consumed by the process were then channeled to the unlined ponds located across the site. This map shows two hogout facilities. These are locations where a water knife was used to safely remove the unused accelerant from the missile casings. And then this is a large source of perchlorate at Aerojet, and it reaches like 100,000 micrograms per liter. Propellant and open burn locations are also shown on this map. Over time, precipitation has caused a migration of the perchlorate through the vadose zone and into groundwater at these locations. There were four landfills located at the site and containing concentrations in groundwater up to 26,000 micrograms per liter. This perchlorate was leached from cardboard boxes used to transport and store perchlorate stock. Slide 74, please. Okay, slide 74 is useful in representing the extent of groundwater extraction treatment areas. Those are the GETs at the site. Let me give you a summary on the groundwater remediation at the site. So far, groundwater remediation as of July 1st, they've treated about 104 billion gallons of water. The current flow rate is about 16,000 gallons per minute. They estimate that they could increase that to 20,000 gallons per minute. 155 pounds of chemical are removed daily, and over 816,000 pounds have been removed to date. Slide 75. This slide summarizes the groundwater remediation activities at Aerojet. This slide also provides an example of the fluidized bed reactor application that Paul discussed on slides 54 and 55. The fluidized bed reactor is the largest treatment system to date. Groundwater extracted through 21 wells is diverted to a system employing four 14-foot diameter, 22-foot high bioreactors operating in a parallel. Each reactor contains about 44,000 pounds of carbon substrata to which ethanol is added as the electron donor. The fluidized bed reactors are equipped with bed cleaning eductor systems that typically adjust the reactor bed height about once a day. Retention times within each reactor average about 12 minutes. The system currently operates at a rate of approximately 5,000 gallons per minute and has demonstrated a capacity to treat 6,000 gallons per minute. The system is capable of reducing its influent concentration of 8,000 micrograms per liter to less than 4 microgram per liter detection limit. The largest treatment system in operation is the ion exchange system located at Get D. The system includes 12 48-inch diameter ion exchange vessels arranged in two parallel banks of six, which allow for operation of a two-stage lead lag treatment process and a flow rate of about 980 gallons per minute. Each vessel contains 60 cubic feet of a once-through gel anion resin, as described by Bob earlier, targeting the perchlorate removal. This site and the off-site GET locations have much lower concentrations of perchlorate than the area remediated by the fluidized bed reactor, so that makes ion exchange more effective. Slide 76. An additional pilot treatment system worth noting is the horizontal flow treatment wells being used to establish a biologically reactive zone in groundwater. At the Environmental Security Technology Certification Program project. This system uses citric acid as the electron donor and chlorine dioxide to control biofouling. The process has demonstrated a 95% reduction in perchlorate, and there has been some success at controlling the mobilization of iron and manganese at this location. So it appears that controlling the oxygen-reducing potential is key to limiting the mobilization. Slide 77. Slide 77 summarizes two examples of perchlorate soil remediation at Aerojet. The Cabot Ranch soil remediation activity was expanded by Aerojet in 2001. 10 Cabot Ranch locations with high levels of perchlorate ranging from 50 to 11,000 milligrams per kilogram were remediated by excavating the soil, mending the soil with cow manure and calcium magnesium acetate, and then returning it to the excavation where it was covered with 6 to 12 inches of composted cow manure. Costs are very competitive at $65 a cubic yard and work very well in the relatively shallow soil situation underlain by bedrock. A deeper beta zone pilot study utilizing similar techniques was not as successful. Aerojet also conducted a pilot test at a former propellant hogout facility to determine the feasibility of using a radial biobarrier to biodegrade perchlorate in both the 30-foot beta zone and shallow groundwater. Groundwater was extracted and potassium oleate added as an electron donor. The water was then returned to the former hogout impoundments where it leached perchlorate through the beta zone and into the groundwater. The perchlorate was then pulled through this biologically active zone and degraded. The process was later modified to include bacterial inoculation. Well, in conclusion, I'd like to point out the success stories that were demonstrated today. The Indian Head Mass pilot study, the Henderson site, and the Aerojet site on slides 45, 55, and 75 respectively, all have demonstrated a greater than 90% reduction in perchlorate. It's a wonderful example of how people in the industry have stepped up to the plate and rapidly developed treatment technologies. Additionally, I think the training clearly points out how widespread and pervasive perchlorate concentrations are in both soil and groundwater. As pointed out by Rose, many of the things that we have taken for granted, like fireworks in the past, do end up being significant sources. Clearly, this is not just a defense and aerospace issue, but one that even affects public utilities using sodium hypochloride to disinfect their drinking water. Okay, slide 79 is an outline of the topics we've discussed. I hope you'll use this to reflect on what questions you might like to ask. At this time, I'm going to turn the discussion over to Juliana for our second question and answer session. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Bruce. On slide 79, we do list the links to additional resources as well as a link to the feedback form. So we're going to get to our questions as soon as we can. And for our simulcast audience, if you'd like, you can use that question mark button at the top of the slides to start sending in questions. Feedback is very important, so we do ask that everyone on the call today fill out that feedback form. You can reach that by following the link on slide 79, or if you've already gone to the links page, along the left, under the Clue in Sun, there's a link over to the feedback. I will go through the links to additional resources before we get to our questions. If you follow slide 79, that link, or again, if you're on the main page, under the Clue in Sun, there's a link that is titled Links. You can download today's ITRC training. That's the first item we have listed. That's going to allow you to download a PowerPoint version of the slides that you've seen during today's training class. In addition to what we've seen on the slides, there's more information in the notes section of this downloaded version. Today's training introduced the Perchlorate 2 document, Remediation Technologies for Perchlorate Contamination in Water and Soil. We do encourage you to review that document, and this link is going to take you over to the ITRC website where you can download a PDF of the second document as well as the overview document that is also available. We have links to other ITRC documents. These are just a few of the things that we've mentioned during today's training class. More information is available on various topics on the ITRC website. In section two of our links to additional resources, we put some links over to some references that we've discussed during today's training class, so you're welcome to scroll through that list to find more information. We do now want to get to as many questions as we can during this question and answer break. For the phone line audience, you are welcome to ask questions out loud. Remember to unmute your phone. That's by selecting #6. Is going to allow you to unmute your phone. And when you ask a question, please state your name and location. And you're welcome to refer to a specific slide number. For our simulcast participants, it's back on the slides is that question mark button at the top of the slide that's going to allow you to send in a question. Who would like to start with questions? Well, we're waiting for questions to come through. For our instructors, I know that the perchlorate project is wrapped up with ITRC. Can you tell us about some of the new projects that you're working on with ITRC while we're waiting for our questions?
This is Paul Hatzinger. I'm currently involved with the Environmental Molecular Diagnostics team, and we're putting together a guidance document looking at different molecular and stable isotope tools and how they can be used to help understand or verify remediation processes.
Thank you.
This is Bob Barnwell. I'm working on the Green and Sustainable Remediation Team, and that's looking at some of these remediation projects from not just an environmental green standpoint, but also from a sustainable point, which is the economic and social sides of those two, and how can you
measure that into remedial projects. There are executive orders out now that are requiring or mandating this to be done, so we're trying to find the best way to incorporate that and utilizing the tools to use as part of the remediation process.
This is Bruce Robinson. I'm currently participating on the Green and Sustainable Remediation Team as well, and I'm trying to bring some of my knowledge as the United States Green Building Council lead AP to the process. I'm also involved in the Contaminated Sediments Team, and that's assessing bioavailability and the potential impact of contaminated sediments to receptors.
I'm also, this is Rose, assisting the Green and Sustainable Remediation Team, assisting them with understanding the initiatives that we're taking here at MassDEP, and what we're doing is we're promoting sustainability in our cleanup program, and we've developed an extensive web page on that information. So I'm just working with them, just trying to get that information to them for their guidance document.
Come to the fall meeting, Rose.
Thank you, and instructors. For more information about ITRC, go to the ITRC website. We've heard some examples of some of the projects that are ongoing. So please go to the website to learn more. Back on perchlorate, we do have a question from our simulcast audience from Mark Selman at SES in Lakewood, Colorado. Are there any special sludge disposal issues related to bioreactor technologies described?
Well, that's a good question. A lot of that depends on local regulatory issues. For the most part, the sludge that's produced by bioreactors is not hazardous. There's no perchlorate associated with that material, and they're non-pathogenic bacteria. So, in terms of the discharge, I believe the material that Aerojet produces, I believe it's landfilled. And the Tronox material as well, I believe is currently landfilled.
This is Bruce Robinson. Yes, Paul's last I heard, they were still continuing to landfill. There is always a potential down the road liability associated with any spent materials from a project like this. So, their risk always plays a factor in the decision making.
Thank you. For our phone line audience, remember it is #6 to unmute the phone, and please state your name and organization when asking a question.
Juliana, this is Bruce Robinson. I'd like to ask Rose a question. Rose, can you tell us more about where you think the promulgation of a standard is going with the EPA? I mean, just based upon your knowledge of monitoring the progress, does it appear that they're going to factor in more the perchlorate in foods into the reference dose?
Yeah, I also think a big issue right now is the impacts of the exposure to infants, and I think that's why EPA under the new administration went back out for public comment. Also, the state of California is reassessing their state MCL for the same reason. When they did their tox evaluation and they came up with that RFD that they used to develop the standard, they didn't have these recent studies on the impacts or the exposure to infants. I think that's the critical issue. I mean, I think the food is important, but the infants and the exposure to infants is the biggest issue. It's been a whole year since that public comment period closed. And I have no idea what they're going to do. I did see an email from one of our lead toxicologists here where there was an article saying that they're set to rule very soon. So I really don't
know.
Rose,
I remember back when Massachusetts was promulgating a standard, the initial thought process was one part per billion. And then you began to find it in your drinking water systems. And
it was the number that was calculated was less than one. The number that was promulgated was two. We were trying to balance, the risk issues with the fact that we were seeing it at very low levels, single digits, in our public water supplies through the disinfection using hypochlorite. And hypochlorite is very solutions are very unstable. The age of the product and the temperature it's stored and all that stuff factor into the fact that it breaks down very quickly. So we were finding it as a source in a couple of our public water supplies that we had tested. And so in the end, to balance those issues, the number two was the magic number that was promulgated.
Have you had any success at instituting best management practices to eliminate the potential from the sodium hypochlorite?
We have not developed a BMP specific in Massachusetts yet on hypochlorite. We have one on firework containing perchlorate containing fireworks, and perchlorate containing blasting agents. We are starting work though with EPA on the development of a BMP. What we have done through our Division of Fire Services is they've sent out a letter. We work closely with them on. I'm sorry, Division of Fire Services, our public water supply group, they're sending letters out to the public water supplies making them aware of what you do and don't want to do with that solution. You don't want it stored for more than 30 days. These are, you know, the temperature we want to store it at. So, yes, informally, but there will be a formal BMP where it's a collaboration between MassDEP and US EPA Region 1.
Excellent. Thanks.
Sure.
We have a simulcast question from Jeff Snar in Minneapolis. What are the depth risks? Restrictions with respect to phytoremediation of perchlorate impacted soil.
I'm sorry, say that again, Juliana, please.
What are the depth restrictions with respect to phytoremediation of perchlorate impacted soil?
Yeah, there are some restrictions on that part. You know, the roots can only go so far down. That's why I mentioned that, you know, in some of the deeper areas where we had contamination a little deeper, they were actually trying to pump the groundwater up from that location and utilize that to water the plants to try to complete on the system. So you do have limitations on the phytoremediation, that's for sure.
And this is Juliana. We do offer a training class on phytoremediation. We offer an internet-based version of that class, and that is going to next be offered on November 16th. So if you go to the ITRC website and look under classroom training, you can see more about that class, and that's going to be offered on Sunday, November 7th. So if you do want to learn more about phytoremediation, you can visit the ITRC website, both for internet-based and short course available in person.
Yeah, check that out. I wasn't trying to dodge the question on exact depth, but those classes will give you some a little more detail on how deep you can utilize that.
So we are out of questions, and we're about out of time as well, so we'll go ahead and wrap up today's training class. I'd like to thank our instructors and our participants for joining us today. If you have not already, please fill out that feedback form. We use the information and appreciate you just taking a few minutes to provide us with your feedback. For more information about ITRC, please visit the ITRC website at www.itrcweb.org. Thanks again, and have a great day.